but you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Ecotopia on KZFI, KZFR. In tonight's program, we'll be looking at some solutions proposed and already in action to greenhouse gas emissions, with a particular focus on how agriculture can help to solve greenhouse gas emissions. Our guests will... Sorry, got lost in the script there. Tonight we'll be talking with Gordon Gregory, Julie Heath, about climate awareness and those partial solutions. Both are active in the Citizens Climate Lobby and doing a number of other environmental activities here in Chico. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County, year-round markets in Chico and at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning, and at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There's also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday mornings. Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia are not necessarily those of KZFR, its staff, management, board of directors, or programmers. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Gordon Gregory and Julie Heath.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening, over this land. I'd a hammer out of danger, I'd a hammer out of warning, I'd a hammer out of love between my brothers and my sisters, over this land. Ooh. If I had a bell, I'd a ring it in the morning, I'd a ring it in the
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. In tonight's program, we'll be looking at some solutions proposed and already in action to greenhouse gas emissions. Our guests on the phone in a few minutes will be Gordon Gregory and Julie Heath. In the meantime, we'll play another tune for you.
A boutique and a swinging hot spot. Don't
seem to go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go, but you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We do have Gordon Gregory on the phone, and Susan is reaching out to Julie Heath at the moment. Are you there, Gordon?
Yes, I am. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Sorry about those problems. We want to ask you, introduce yourself, please. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you became involved in citizen climate lobby and other activities, including teaching about climate change here in the Chico area.
Sure. Well, I'm a former newspaper reporter, worked for daily papers in Montana and Oregon, focused mainly on environmental and natural resource issues. So I've always had a deep curiosity in what is happening in the natural world and kind of a penchant for doing research about a whole variety of issues, including climate change. I'm retired now. And I've become increasingly...
Did I hang up?
You hung up on Gordon.
Fucking man.
Don't say that aloud for the moment.
I'm...
Sorry about this, folks. We're having our usual myriad technical difficulties. We'll get them both on the air in a moment. In the meantime, there is an update regarding the Dixie Fire. Dixie Fire burned actively overnight, moving to the east and north. Firefighting air and ground resources will continue to work together to construct direct line to secure the fire perimeter. Firefighters continue to construct contingency lines to provide structure defense in communities at risk. The fire is burning in remote areas with limited access and steep terrain. A portion of SR 70 is closed to all traffic. It's closed at Jarbo Gap up to the turnoff in Quincy, leading up to Almanor. The evacuation orders, this as of a few minutes ago, actually, High Lakes Region, recreational area of Plumas County, east of the Butte-Plumas County line, Plumas-Butte County line east to Twain. It includes both sides of Highway 70. So the fire has, in fact, jumped Highway 70 in the areas of Rock Creek, Story, Tobin, Belden, Caribou, Rich Bar, and Twain. They're also evacuating up at the Bucks Lake Road area and at Snake Lake Road west to the Plumas Butte County line, including the area of Tollgate. Also in Butte County, the communities of Jonesville and Philbrook areas. You can refer to Public Map on the BCSO website. That's www.buttecountynetsheriff for information. Or you can call 833-512-5378. Let me ask my co-host here, do we have somebody on the line?
No, I just dropped him.
Again? Let's play a tune.
I've got him right now.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. I swear. Okay. It should happen.
Hi there, Gordon. Again, are you there?
Yes, hi there. Yes, I am.
Okay, we were talking a little bit about your background. You were a newspaper reporter. You worked in Montana and Oregon covering the environment. More recently involved with Citizens Climate Lobby. And you were started talking about the courses that you have been teaching, and we're going to ask you a little bit more about those later. But tell us what teaching you have been doing about climate change.
Well, primarily through the Osher Lifelong Living Institute, which is connected with Chico State University for several years now. I've been teaching a course on climate change twice a year, as well as just this year I added another course on the relationship between climate change and wildfire. It's become such a big issue in our area in particular, but throughout the West as well. I've also given forums in some North State communities, Quincy, Susanville, Mohawk, which is up by Portola, focused on the relationship between wildfire and climate change, what are those communities can expect in the future under various greenhouse gas scenarios between wildfire and climate change, what and things that they may be able to do to protect themselves
in the future.
So that's mainly what I've been doing, as well as just, you know, trying to communicate with individuals in my community about the issue, and frequent communications with our member of Congress, Doug LaMalfa's office, and others.
And you lost your home in Paradise in the Camp Fire?
Actually, we lost our home.
Or the Humboldt Fire.
2008,
yeah.
Humboldt Fire. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of other rental houses that my wife and I remodeled that were destroyed in the Camp Fire. And the family members who lost a number of homes as well. So wildfire has been a big part of
the
experience. And also, I used to, when I was a young man, I used to fight fire with the Forest Service on hotshot and helitack crews. Went all over the West on the big fire, so I've got a little bit of perspective of how things seem to have changed regarding the size and ferocity of these fires, that simply we didn't encounter a deadly fire was very, very rare, and now it's practically an annual occurrence in the West, and we just didn't see that in the past.
And great empathy and concern for the firefighters. We see them around here checking into the hotel after long shifts. They're carrying heavy loads up those brutal slopes. I don't know how they do it.
It's exhausting. I can tell you that. And in this heat, it's incredibly draining.
Mm-hmm. Do we have Julie on the phone?
Julie, do we have you?
Hi.
Oh, good. Thank
you. I'm here.
Thank the Lord.
Okay. Sorry for all that. So we'll rush into our question. Julie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a person who was a scientist who retired to Chico about 7 years ago after a career in medicinal chemistry research. I've been involved with CCL as a cold group leader, and now I'm spending most of my climate action time with the National Agriculture Team. So I'm going to be speaking today about agriculture, food, and the climate. And I do believe that agriculture can literally save the planet, because if we can get our act together and stop putting carbon into the atmosphere, there's still a lot that would remain up there, but we can draw it down using agriculture and soil systems. And that's what that hopeful note is what I would like to talk about today.
Okay. We are eager to hear about that. We're going to start with some questions that are mostly for Gordon. But Julie, jump in at any time in this discussion. Mm-hmm. Gordon, you started to talk about your background. What drew you both, really, to Citizens Climate Lobby? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what it is and what it's working for.
Sure. I have, as I mentioned, been very interested and concerned about climate change going back at least a decade. Starting 5 or 6 years ago, I was looking for ways to get involved in trying to promote action on climate change. And when I came across Citizens Climate Lobby, it was immediately appealing because they had a plan that made a lot of sense to me. They were focused on national legislation. They gained or derived their influence from citizen action, the idea that we live in a democracy and that our political leaders will eventually follow the will of the people, and if we can just basically mobilize that popular support, we will get federal action. Their solution, which is particularly attractive to me, is to get Congress to adopt legislation that would put a fee on the carbon content of fossil fuels. This would happen at the source, the mine or the well, and it would be based on the carbon content so that the more carbon that is mined or extracted, the higher the cost would be of that fuel. The per ton cost would start small, it would increase annually, it would immediately create a market disincentive to use fossil fuels, and it would create an incentive to find alternatives to fossil fuels. The other part of the legislation I thought was particularly attractive is it would take that money and return it in equal shares to all residents of the country so that they could, in essence, afford the rising cost of fuel and commodities. Anything with a carbon footprint, the price would go up. There's other elements of that legislation that's very attractive. But the key things were the idea of political support, citizen directed, a powerful idea or a solution, and also bipartisan in nature. They insist that whatever we do is bipartisan. We're not a partisan organization in any fashion.
Right. The world should be past discussions of whether or not climate change is real. Even so, there are a lot of people out there, if they're not deniers, at least they're not jumping on the bandwagon, they're not wholeheartedly supporting actions on climate change. What are some of the reasons for that, do you think, Gordon?
There's a number of reasons that make sense to me. Partly, it's a fairly complicated subject. It takes a little bit of explaining to show why the burning of fossil fuels is leading to the heating of the planet. It's a little bit non-intuitive to think that if you adjust the atmosphere by particular molecules in measurements of parts per million or a few hundred parts per million, that you can affect the weather and actually create all of these negative consequences that we're beginning to see today. So it's a little anti-intuitive. It's a scary subject. A lot of people don't want to think about it, and I think that's personally really understandable. I think the biggest effect reason right now is that there's been a long, decades-long concerted effort by fossil fuel companies and others, conservative free market ideological think tanks, that have purposely created or attempted to create doubt about either the science of climate change, the severity of its impacts, or now the ability that people have to reverse things. I think that effort has been wildly successful. They have politicized it to an extent that if you are a Republican, particularly from a conservative region or state, it is politically almost a death kill to work towards trying to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. I think that's been very, very damaging, and I think that a lot of people listen to their political leaders, and when you have people like our former president say it's a hoax, and when you have people like our congressman, Doug LaMalfa, say that there's mm-hmm. nothing to this. A lot of people take that on face value. So I think that's a big part of it, is this concerted effort.
Mm-hmm. It also, until recently, has seemed to be in the far distant future. And we're wondering if current wildfires, the floods in Europe, various catastrophes around the globe, Siberia is burning. Do you think that helps to bring it home so that people may take more action than they would have if we'd remained in a more peaceful climate existence?
I suspect it has to have some effect. I was just in Central Oregon. I was up there when that heat wave was most intense. When I was in Central Oregon, which is where I used to work, I covered the central counties of Central Oregon for the Oregonian, very conservative area. Climate change was not a topic that people would consider, or in general. This is a gross generalization. And when I was up there, and it was 111 degrees in Prineville, in a place that just does not get hot. 100 degrees is a hot day up there, but 111 was absolutely unheard of. And people are at least acknowledging that things are changing. Last year's wildfires, this year's wildfires, mm-hmm. Are showing that our weather is not what it used to be. I didn't hear many people necessarily address it to climate change, but I think it felt mm-hmm. to me, it's just a half step away from acknowledging that, yes, our weather is different, and the reason it's different is because we have affected the climate. I can't help but think that it's going to have that effect. If nothing else, we're seeing it so much more in the news than even just a few years ago. I mean, mm-hmm. daily you mm-hmm. read and hear about climate change when you didn't used to. And now we have these big weather events, whether they're floods or fires or last year's hurricane season, and immediately those stories are starting to connect to experts who will draw the linkage to climate change, or at least begin saying that the correlation suggests that climate change is a factor.
We've had guests on this program, most notably Guy McPherson, who say that it's too late. We're already past the tipping point, that mass extinction is inevitable, and that it will be something that happens soon and immediately. What is your view of the nearness of the end?
I understand his thinking completely. I think Julie's component of this interview is going to be very helpful with showing how there's hope even in drawing down CO2 in the atmosphere once we begin limiting and then ending our contributions to the buildup of greenhouse gases. We have changed the climate in fundamental ways today. The CO2 that we have been putting in the atmosphere since the start of the Industrial Revolution, most of that CO2 is going to be around again, with the exception of what can be absorbed back into the ground and into other into trees and plant growth and stuff. Most of that's going to be in the atmosphere for generations, and it will continue to have a heating effect, because every CO2 molecule, every methane molecule, and there's a few others, chemicals in the atmosphere, will continue to absorb heat from the sun. So that's true. The thing, I think, though, that people really need to keep in mind is that we do have the ability to limit the increase, the level of increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2018 said, that the difference between keeping global average temperatures to less than 2 degrees centigrade increase over historic norms and greater than that is huge. Mm-hmm. We can keep temperatures to close to 2 degrees and possibly even less than 2 degrees centigrade mm-hmm. increase if we take enough action soon enough. If we, however, wait, the consequences could be will be far worse and could be catastrophic. So we can't give up hope is what I'm trying to say. The difference between a difficult climate and a horrible climate,
yes,
I think, is
yeah.
profound. And there's nothing right now that indicates that we are inevitably on, or at least nothing I've read. I don't think there's that, you know, sufficient information out there that says that we don't have the power to make our future a good deal better than it might be if we don't take adequate action.
You've taught climate change classes through OLLI, and you've done presented on the subject of wildfire and climate change in Quincy and Mohawk and Susanville. And you've been encouraged by the level of concern by those in attendance at the in the rural communities where you've talked to people. So what do you tell people, and what kind of responses are you getting?
It's interesting. I think, to be honest, I think, you know, probably most of the people that have come to a forum on climate change are those who are concerned about it already, or mm-hmm. at least have some level of openness to it. There have been people, particularly in my classes, that have come that will come there with their own information about why it's not real or it's not going to be as severe, and they, you know, kind of contrarian attitudes. Mm-hmm. But most people are already a little bit inclined to it. What I have seen, particularly in these forums in the smaller communities, is that some local political leaders will come there because they are concerned particularly about wildfire, and they want to know, well, what can we expect in the future if we don't get greenhouse gas emissions under control? They've seen, particularly like in Quincy, where they have dodged a couple of near bullets in terms of wildfire. Fire. And right now, I mean, that
yes.
area
yeah.
With the Dixie fires under yep. threat. So that level of concern, which kind of ties into the previous subject about whether what we're seeing today is heightening people's interest in the subject, they are interested. They want to know, if nothing else, what they can do to protect their communities, and which is part of our presentation as well. I've been encouraged that there are people who are concerned, they're interested, and even some conservatives in the area. We've talked to some county supervisors up in Plumas County who have expressed deep interest in the subject and concern for their community's futures, primarily, again, because of wildfire. But I suspect this drought's going to also broaden their perspective of what they might face in the future.
We have some action going on. People are starting to, governments are starting to take climate seriously, and the European Union is getting pretty strong. They're enacting a comprehensive package of climate change laws. And California has done a pretty good job with reducing emissions in cars and trucks and electrical generation plants. What else do we need? Is that sufficient, or what else needs to happen?
It's what we're doing today on the state, local, and national, international level is far from what is needed. I think that what we're doing is helping. Some of it's going to buy us some time, maybe, but we need to do much, much more. To keep in mind that we not only need to convert our transportation and energy sectors and much of our land use activities to carbon neutral, in terms of land use activities, to carbon negative practices, we also have to allow for additional energy generation. It's predicted that through population growth and through the uplift of people out of poverty into the middle class, that we're going to need 50% more power generation by 2050 than we have today. All that has to also be clean, because we simply have to stop contributing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere at least by 2050. So it's a huge, huge undertaking. What we're doing today is helpful. We're going to have to do a lot more on really all levels of activity, from the individual to our cities, such as, you know, Chico's Action Plan. I think it would be very helpful what the state's doing. The nation's got to get behind it. The Biden administration will probably go down as or could go down as one of the best in terms of climate change in the history of the country. European Union is starting to take action, or at least presenting policies that look very positive, but it's going to have to involve the whole world, China, Russia, India. We're all going to have to get behind this, and that's a big lift.
Yeah.
Let's ask Julie Heath to jump in at this point.
Yes.
one of her, we kind of cut you short, Gordon, because of our technical problems, but we want to hear what Julie has to say, because she's talking about not just lowering emissions, but reversing the trend a little bit. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Tell us about CCL's National Agricultural Team. You've gotten pretty excited about all of this. This is not an area where you had spent time previously. So tell us what's the potential here for ag, large and small, to get involved.
Well, first, let me thank you for giving us the opportunity to present this subject to your listeners. I think it's vital that people learn actually that this is going on and that there is some hope, because I don't know, but so I remember the very, very, very clearly the first moment that I became aware that we could draw down CO2 into the soil. This was years ago, and I was getting more and more pessimistic about humanity's potential for survival. I was really depressed about it. So a radio program not very unlike this one reported on an experiment that was run by the Nature Conservancy, I think somewhere in Sacramento, where they, you know, the river delta or something, where they demonstrated that the soil carbon content of the land had been increased in a marsh. And that was just, like, mind blown. So I figured it was probably not enough carbon to make a difference, but wow, guess what? It actually is. And that's the main reason I've joined this ag team in the National Ag Team for CCL. Let's be clear, like you know, going back to net zero with our carbon emissions is not enough to stabilize the climate. We have to go from the current 415 or 20-ish atmosphere CO2 much closer back to 280 parts per million that we were at when Queen Victoria's reign began. And that's, what, a couple hundred years ago? Not even?
Yeah.
So that's daunting, right? But it is not yet impossible. We do have to stop emitting pollutant gases, and we have to remove carbon dioxide from the air. But we are learning that we can plant it literally and figuratively in the ground. Transforming our agricultural practices is the most effective, economic, eco-friendly way that's actually known currently to remove carbon. And it's eminently scalable, which you cannot say for most tech solutions. Before I go further, I want to state my very big appreciation. I've become addicted to ag podcasts and webinars and things like that in the last few months. And I want to say how much I appreciate the work that our farmers and ranchers do to feed and clothe us. I want to appreciate their dignity, their resourcefulness, their amazing adaptability, and their ability to make it work despite all the difficulties that Mother Nature is throwing at them. These folks are the stewards of our soil, and they are aware of it. It's their legacy. Now, of course, all of us want clean air, pure water, and healthful food for our families. These stewards of the land are on the front lines as the climate changes and weather becomes more unpredictable. Agriculture relies on predictable weather. Don't forget that. They are facing unexpected weather events, droughts, flooding, windstorms, prolonged heat events, and more. As Gordon mentioned, about 98% of actively publishing climate scientists say that these naturally occurring events have become more frequent and often more intense as a direct result of our changing climate. Agriculture has an important role to play in both reducing the threat of global warming and in making our food and fiber system more resilient to its impacts. The newest research is saying that about a third of all man-made greenhouse gases are from food systems worldwide. This includes the transport, the packaging, the food waste, and all those other related costs. About 71% of that is from agriculture itself, and 32% is from land use changes, which include deforestation and, very importantly, land degradation. Now, this land degradation part is not small. We've lost about 30% of cropland worldwide to degradation in just the last 40 years. I want you to step back and let that sink in. Nearly a third of cropland has been lost. At home, the U.S. estimates that, I think it was the USDA actually, estimates that 11% of our greenhouse gas footprint is from the agriculture system itself, not the whole food system, just agriculture. In America, we are eating about a ton of food per person per year, give or take a few pounds, which is equivalent to emitting a couple of tons of CO2 equivalents for that. Our average footprint in total is a shocking 20 metric tons of CO2, which is way more than the worldwide 4 tons on average. And yet, one of the easiest ways that we as individuals can use to decrease our carbon footprints is to eat lower on the food chain or to seek out the higher quality grass-fed and rotationally grazed animal products. If you do intend to eat meat, this is the way to do it, in a way that's better for the animals, for the planet, and quite frankly, for your own health as well. Rotational grazing is usually carbon negative. So instead of emitting carbon like animals in feedlots, rotationally grazed animals actually draw down carbon into the soil.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the predicted local impacts of climate change on our agricultural economy? What's happening to us?
Well, so there are a lot. In Butte County, our biggest crops right now are almonds, rice, walnuts, prunes, peaches, kiwi fruit, and we've also got quite a bit of cattle. I will say that of all of those, it seems like almonds are going to be the least sensitive to the problem. Actually, I don't know about kiwi fruit, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But water stress will affect all of them, mm-hmm. which we're seeing right now with the mega drought. With the dry summers, we all rely on our reservoirs. Precipitation that's in the Sierra falling as rain rather than what should be snow as the climate heats up means that we're going to have floods, because rain falling on snow, even if you get snow, is going to melt the snow. So that means that we are going to have a lack of water storage for farmers, because snowpacks are actually our biggest reservoir. Mm-hmm. And it's a big reservoir we never had to build.
Mm-hmm.
But that only works if it's cold enough for everything to stay snow for longer and to melt slowly into the summer. So that's huge. Obviously, there are droughts like the current mega drought. They're expected to increase. They're expected to become more severe. Right now, we're seeing that farmers are not planting crops, especially rice, due to water uncertainty. It's less risky for them to sell their water downstream than to farm it. And I'm going to bring up a slightly off-point thing, but with all of this scenario, it's predicted that we could have Chico Creek actually become seasonal.
Mm-hmm. That's a heartbreak.
We're expecting more heat waves, and if it gets too hot, we're going to find that there are going to be crop plants that actually can't weather it. Gordon gave you some of the numbers for where we're going in terms of temperatures in this area. Let's put it in perspective. During Bidwell's time, our area had an average of about 3 days that were over 103 degrees or higher. Guess how many we have now? And I don't know the answer this year, but it's been a lot, right?
Yeah.
Well, you can expect that number to climb. And if we don't get our act together, which I hope we do, the current trajectory says that by around 2100, we would expect to have our area have temperatures somewhat near the desert down by the Mexican border. So we'd be in full desert here, which obviously will not jive with the plant ecosystem that we have or most of the crops that we're growing. But in the near term, some of the first things that we're going to lose are like the stone fruits, for example, one of our big crops is peaches. We actually grow more peaches in Butte County than they grow in Georgia, even though that's the peach state. But you have to have a certain number of chill hours in the winter for those fruits to develop. We are expecting that peaches are going to be a thing of the past, and within, I forget what it was, a couple of decades or 3 decades or something, not very long. So, and of course, wildfires are going to affect all of us, even farmers. And even if your crops don't burn down, let's remember that we're having these massive smoke events, and the smoke blocks the sun. It affects how fast things ripen. If you're a winery, the smoke taints the flavor of the wine, and you literally cannot wash it off. I've talked to, you know, people in the business. That's it, the crops absorb that smokiness, and it ruins the wine. So we are going to see a lot of crops migrating north and probably being replaced by other crops. So, you know, there will be changes that gradually happen, and we're seeing that already. Wine, for example, wine grapes are moving north. And, of course, cattle rely on the forage that you're able to grow, and if there's less water and it's harder to grow the forage, then the stocking rates have to go down, which is going to impact the amount of cattle that can be raised in the area. So that's a sampling of the things that would be happening around here.
I just have a side question. Are farmers anticipating that? I know that the city of Chico at one point did a study of climate change and what will be best to grow when the climate changes. Is that word getting out to farmers, and are they anticipating the kinds of things that they'll have to grow to survive as farmers?
You know, I am on the ag team, but I have to admit that I have not specifically spoken with a whole lot of our local people, so I don't know the answer to that question.
Right.
I do think it would be worthwhile to have a big forum that was, you know, recorded and put out there and then, you know, made available. And I have heard anecdotally of peach farmers who are, you know, have had the peaches in the business in the family for generations, and they're, you know, selling them to other people who maybe haven't got the knowledge of that.
So,
or don't want to believe it.
Right, or don't want to believe it, right. So how does agriculture contribute to greenhouse gases?
Well, there are various types of contributions, and also there's the loss of carbon dioxide from the soils themselves, which is huge. Carbon is life. Soils are a massive carbon sink, and I wish I could remember the exact numbers, but I don't. The currently popular agricultural practices deplete that sink gradually over time, and they release it into the air. This is not a small effect. Over time, the loss of CO2 from the soil is more than half of the amount of the CO2 that's actually in the air. We release this by tilling the soil, leaving fields barren, which is happening right now, and fallow for months. We lose it by erosion, and we lose it by other practices that kill off the soil's microbial life. Think of the various types of chemicals that are applied. This loss of topsoil is a disturbing problem, as the UN actually predicts that we only have about 60 harvests left if we continue on the current path. I'm nearly that old myself, so, you know, you might imagine it doesn't seem very long to me.
No.
Let's be clear that farmers are not to blame for using the practices. They would never, I'm sure, intentionally degrade their own soil. These are the ways that they've farmed for many decades, and these practices were promoted by policy and also by our scientifically incomplete understanding of the biology that's involved. It's only really in about the last decade or so that we have begun to understand more about the soil, the microorganisms in it, mm-hmm. and how the microorganisms actually interact with plants.
Julia, I want to inject for just a moment and add to your list that capitalism has driven a lot of that degradation of the soil. Farmers under pressure to grow larger and larger acreages, factory farming, as you say, the use of fertilizers and so forth.
Pesticides.
This is not to blame the farmers, but those kinds of pressures and the use of water. I was just on a Zoom call with Mark Arax, who wrote a book called The Dreamt Land. It's mostly about Southern California. And he talks about really the abuse of the land by big business farmers who keep growing stuff that shouldn't be planted there in the first place, who keep going for more and more acreage. He even says drip systems are partly at blame, because now you can run your drip lines out there where nothing would grow without a drip system. So I just want to throw that in also as one of these causes that's going to have to be reversed over time if we're to see big changes in ag practices.
Absolutely. There are many, many reasons that people do the things they do, and let's all admit that the money talks, and many, many people do things for that reason. They don't necessarily know what the full effects of what they're doing are. So, I mean, maybe some of them do, but mm-hmm. I would say that a lot of times people just say, oh, this is a great way to make more money, and they don't maybe understand how damaging what they're doing actually is. So,
yes,
you know, I guess I always like to think of people as not being evil, but people do, psychologically, people do tend to understand things from the lens of their own situation and what's good for them.
Farmers do what's traditional. They pass it down from one to another, and they have people coming out to sell them products that they say, this will, you know, do great things for your land. And so they're kind of in, you know, they're in their tradition. And
and also, if you couple that with the uncertainty that you talked about earlier, you never know whether you're going to have a drought year or a wet year. Yeah, I'm very empathetic to the plight of farmers. So it's understandable that you would build resilience into the system just by planting more and more acres, by putting on more and more fertilizer to make sure you can turn a profit at the end of the year. It's quite understandable.
So, but you think there's hope. It's not all bad news, because there are things that are happening that are turning things around, yes?
Yeah, I believe, well, maybe it's because of the bubble that I'm in.
Yeah.
You know how it is with the bubbles you can get into. But what I'm hearing is that it isn't all doom and gloom right now. So I like to think of all of this like we're in a superhero movie. And the fossil fuel genie has to be defeated, and then it has to be put back into the bottle. And that the bottle is the soil, and farmers and ranchers are the superheroes that can do that. So that's my silly little thing. Happily, right now, there is a big buzz around soil health. And some people call it regenerative style farming.
Mm-hmm.
That, believe it or not, can be a problem for farmers, because they say, well, I'm not farming degeneratively. Because, you know, you don't want to be told that what you've done for the last 30 years is actually degenerative. You know, you can see why a person would feel a little insulted. But anyway, so some of the major players that are working in agriculture are actually starting to really support work like this. General Mills is committed to a million regenerative acres by 2030. Danone has made big commitments. Land O'Lakes, which is bigger than you think, it's not just the butter, it's a huge conglomerate of farmers. They are also supporting soil health ag initiatives and creating mechanisms for farmers to learn how to do it and stuff like that. And right now there are also private carbon credit markets, which are paying farmers to sequester carbon. So we're seeing businesses all over the map, organizations and individuals who can buy these carbon credits. More and more businesses of all types are coming, are committing themselves to net zero by, you know, fill in the date.
Right.
And this is one way that they have, that they use to deal with their very hardest to eliminate emissions. Oftentimes those are emissions from their skylines or that type of thing. So I'd like to give kudos to our innovative pioneering farmers who are developing the regenerative agriculture system. Also to the scientists who are who have been investigating and learning a lot more about the soil and all that. And there are other farmers who are then beginning to find, you know, try out these practices. And although every farm is individual and it can be quite tough, most of them are finding that not only does the sky not fall down, but over time they need fewer of those pricey inputs like fertilizer and herbicides and pesticides. Their profitability improves and resistance to extreme weather also improves. Scientists are working hard to catch up to understand all of this properly, and I'm proud to say that one of the best known schools in the nation for this, even in the world really, is our own Chico State.
Yes.
That said, transitioning a farm is a step. It does take time. It takes commitment. I want you to know that the average age of a farmer in this country is 58, so you're asking something. And the benefits often lag a few years behind that implementation because it takes some time to build the soil back. But it, things that help out with that is each extra 1% of soil organic carbon will retain about 27,000 gallons of water per acre. So healthy soils are not only absorbing more water, but they're also doing it way faster, which decreases the possibility of flooding, erosion, runoff, and the consequent loss of those expensive fertilizers and topsoils and all the other nutrients. Nutrient and fertilizer loss is actually a very expensive inconvenience for farmers who are in quite a bit of debt these days, actually, debt has been skyrocketing.
Yeah.
These compounds also cause cancer in the drinking water, and nitrate runoff has created a massive dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and many other places. Fertilizers are also very greenhouse gas intensive themselves to produce. So the costly inputs like herbicides, insecticides, and those also decrease because with more carbon in the soil, the plants are healthier. This means fewer tractor passes, less diesel fuel to run the tractors, and it also means less time on the tractor away from the family. So farmers that make it through the transition years are generally way more profitable and they have a better quality of life. And this can literally save the family farm too, since the debt loads, like I said, have skyrocketed in recent years as farmers have been on this vicious cycle of higher inputs leading to less healthy soil, leading to the need for more inputs, leading to less healthy soil, et cetera, et cetera. So once transitioning, farming is fun again is actually a typical quote.
Julie, we're running a little low on time here. We've just passed a note. We're going to want to get you back on the show again because we have a lot of questions about the specifics of this kind of sustainable or regenerative agriculture, what it looks like, how you get the carbon back in the soil, how you reverse, we don't want to call it degradation, I guess, but how you reverse the trends that have been going on, and how you do it on as a big enough scale to make a big difference. So we hope you'll come back on the show again. And likewise, Gordon, we'd like to hear more, and maybe you could give us a minute or two at the close about Citizens Climate Lobby, how people can learn more about that, and perhaps get involved in the local chapters and take some specific action. Gordon,
sure.
Or Julie? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And again, thanks for having us on. It's been a real pleasure. I love your program. We have a our local chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby became quasi, inactive during the pandemic. In fact, we've linked up with the Reading CCL, or Citizens Climate Lobby chapter, where we do, you know, once a month online meetings. We talk about ways that we can support action on a federal level, or we can do locally. You can learn about the broad kind of scope of Citizens Climate Lobby. Simply just Google Citizens Climate Lobby and go to our webpage, which is citizensclimatelobby.com, I believe, not org. And you can look at...
You can do CCLUSA.org.
CCLUSA.org, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll get you there.
And from that webpage, you can look at joining a local chapter. If you join, you'll get a call from one of us. We can talk about what we're doing and ways that you might be able to get involved. It's a real opportunity, actually, to take direct action, even as simple things as, you know, writing a letter to the editor. But we lobby in Congress twice a year. We go back to D.C. Didn't do it, of course, in 2020. We did it by...
But we did meet with their office.
I'm so sorry, Julie.
We did meet with the office by Zoom.
Yeah.
Or I guess it was by phone.
Yeah, we had distant...
We did lobby.
Lobby meetings. But we'll be going back. I don't know for sure it's going to be this fall, but I would expect so. There's opportunities to learn about how you lobby Congress and get direct experience doing that. You can see, you know, really what is the potential for individuals to begin shaping the national dialogue and national action. So I think it's a great kind of a way to get involved with climate change. There's other local groups that are very valuable as well. But
so, Gordon, can I pitch in just for a moment?
Please.
You have about 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Right now, we have been told by the National Citizens Climate that if you think that pricing carbon is a good thing to do, right now it is the most important 3 weeks that we have ever had for making sure that a version of carbon pricing makes it into the reconciliation bill.
Wow.
This is like super important for us right now. And Gordon and I and Tamara, who's up in Reading, are going to be meeting right, you know, tomorrow probably, to figure out how do we activate as many people as possible to make a phone call to our senators or take an email or something to tell them that you care about this, because we want them to care enough to make it happen.
Our guests have been Julie Heath and Gordon Gregory with a discussion of some ways people are engaging productively in reducing the dangers of climate change. Thank you so much for your enthusiasm, your information, and your activism. We appreciate your work. Stay tuned for North State Give and Take, and with Bobby Tryon, she'll be talking about pursuit safety. And at 6:30, it's Radioactive with Ginger Nichols. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to KZFR for the rest of the night.
Up next is North State Give and Take. And North State Give and Take is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters, that's you, and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party's been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923, and by the Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image, open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and by appointment. More information by calling 530-898-9525.